Macmillan Audio presents Killing the Rising Sun, How America Vanquished World War II Japan, by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Read for you by Robert Petkoff.
This book is dedicated to all World War II veterans. Freedom rings because of you. The Land of the Rising Sun. Ancient Chinese description of Japan, referring to the morning suns reaching the islands of Japan before the Asian mainland.
A note to readers. On September 16, 2001, 5 days after the savage attack launched by the Al-Qaeda terrorists on the United States, Barack Obama's longtime Chicago pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., delivered a stunning anti-American diatribe in his church, listing what he believed to be atrocities America had committed in the past that would explain or perhaps justify the 9/11 mass murder. Wright got around to condemning his country for dropping two atomic bombs on Japan in 1945. Quote, "We bombed Hiroshima, we bombed Nagasaki, and we nuked far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon. America's chickens are coming home to roost," unquote. 7 years later, Wright's explosive statements were uncovered by the media. Senator Obama, then campaigning to become president, quickly repudiated his pastor's assessment, distancing himself from the militant minister who officiated at his wedding and with whom he had had a close relationship for about 20 years. It is safe to say that many people around the world had little or no idea what Wright was even talking about. Sure, most folks know that the A-bombs were dropped and the carnage caused was catastrophic. But, sad to say, the events leading up to the end of World War II are not widely known anymore. Thus, statements like the one Wright made sometimes go unchallenged. Every person on this planet lives with a common threat: nuclear annihilation. The nuclear weapons of today dwarf the first A-bombs in destructive power. Currently, the Iranian nuclear treaty has raised awareness of the threat, but still, the nuclear bomb's origins and the brutal world of the mid-1940s are no longer common knowledge. Enter this book. It comes with a warning. The following pages contain some extremely troubling material. The violence the world witnessed in 1945 is unprecedented in history and will be chronicled on the following pages in detail. What Martin Dugard and I are about to tell you is true and stark. The way the United States defeated the Japanese Empire is vital to understand because the issues of that war are still being processed throughout the world today. Killing the Rising Sun is the sixth in our series of history books. We believe you will know far more about America by this book's end. We also believe you will be very able to put the comments of people like Reverend Wright in their proper context. We live in a time of spin and deception. It is important to know the truth. Here it is.
Introduction. Oval Office, the White House, Washington, D.C., October 12, 1939, 10 a.m. The age of mass destruction is about to dawn. What bright idea do you have now? An upbeat Franklin Delano Roosevelt asks Wall Street financier Alexander Sachs, one of his key advisors on the New Deal that lifted America out of the Great Depression. The 46-year-old economist sits on the opposite side of the president's massive wooden desk. FDR was up past midnight, as is his custom. The deep circles under his eyes and his pale skin, resulting from constant exhaustion and too little time spent outdoors, make the president look far older than his 57 years. His health is not enhanced by the Camel cigarette he now holds, one of the more than 20 he will smoke today. Sachs chooses his reply carefully. This meeting is so top secret that it will not appear in the official daily log of presidential appointments. Sachs can only hope that it will go better than the hour he spent with Roosevelt yesterday, when he labored unsuccessfully to find the right words to describe what could possibly be the greatest single threat to mankind. It has been 6 weeks since Nazi Germany invaded Poland, beginning what will become known as the Second World War. 1 month prior, on August 2nd, theoretical physicist Albert Einstein wrote an urgent letter to President Roosevelt warning that it may become possible to set up a nuclear chain reaction in a large mass of uranium. Extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. Einstein is a longtime friend of Roosevelt's, but he felt that sending Alexander Sachs to deliver the letter in person would be the most effective way of getting his point across. But when Sachs finally managed to get an audience with Roosevelt yesterday morning, the pompous financier was unable to articulate his case. Rather than simply reading Einstein's 2-page letter aloud, he appeared in the Oval Office with a stack of technical papers detailing America's uranium output and then read from an 800-word summary he had written. Sachs never mentioned that Einstein and other top American scientists believe that the new bombs could obliterate entire cities, or that Nazi Germany is currently racing to build such weapons. Roosevelt grew bored as Sachs droned on. With pressing business to address, the president dismissed Sachs, telling him to come back the next day. That time is now. Realizing his mistake, Sachs gets right down to business. As Roosevelt listens attentively, the Wall Street leader reads Einstein's letter aloud. The president may not have appeared to be listening yesterday, but some of the discussion seems to have sunk in. Roosevelt probes Sachs with questions about uranium, the Nazis, and this new bomb. Einstein's letter makes it clear that the Germans have already taken control of a key uranium mine in Czechoslovakia, and that scientists at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin are attempting to use this uranium to set up a nuclear chain reaction that could lead to the most lethal bomb in history. Roosevelt has finally heard enough. "Alex," he summarizes for the financier, "what you are after is to see that the Nazis don't blow us up."
"Precisely," a relieved Sachs answers.
Roosevelt immediately summons his personal secretary, retired U.S. Army General Edwin Pa Watson, into the Oval Office. "Pa," Roosevelt orders, "this requires action." 1. Peleliu, Caroline Islands, Pacific Ocean, September 15, 1944, 0832 hours. Destruction is near for the Empire. The morning heat is so unbearable that Corporal Lewis Kenneth Bossell, USMC, has trouble breathing. He is huddled inside an amphibious landing vehicle with a dozen other Marines of the 1st Battalion, headed for the section of Japanese-held beach codenamed Orange 1. Even this early in the morning, the temperature hovers at 100 degrees. The Americans are sweating profusely as their armored craft brings them ever closer to the sand. But heat is not the only factor. Some of the perspiration is from nerves. These Marines understand that they may soon die or be maimed for life, and few will ever know what happened to them. Unlike in the much more publicized war in Europe, where reporters like Ernie Pyle and Edward R. Murrow are making names for themselves by covering every aspect of the fighting, there are no journalists or photographers hitting this remote beach today. The crucial upcoming battle against the Japanese will be waged in near anonymity. Peleliu is important because of its airstrip, a hard-surfaced field capable of launching long-range fighter bombers. The island is just 6 miles long and 2 miles wide, but the terrain is exceptionally rugged, a film of thin soil laid atop coral and limestone. 1,000 yards off the beach rise the jungle-covered Umurbrugal ridges, a series of low, jagged peaks forming the island's spine. The Japanese have long coveted tiny remote Peleliu, first taking possession of the empty island in 1914. For 2 decades it remained basically unused, but with the war came renewed awareness of its tactical importance. Since this past summer, knowing that the Americans would soon attack, the Japanese have labored to transform Peleliu into a fortress. Most American Marines could not care less about the history of Peleliu. Each man approaches the coming battle in his own way. Some smoke to calm their fears, some vomit onto the steel deck, and others worry about wetting their pants. But there is one belief that every man shares. No matter what happens when they hit the beach, surrendering to the enemy will not be an option. Louis Bousselle has been through this before. Only 20 years old, the apprentice bookbinder from Washington, D.C., has an easy smile and a wide boxer's nose. His hair is cropped close to his skull. Bousselle had a semester left at McKinley Technical High School when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in December 1941. He immediately dropped out of school and tried to enlist in the Navy, but was rejected. So instead, he enlisted in the Marine Corps. During his more than 2 years serving his country, Bousselle has earned the respect of his peers, and although his rank is not yet official, just 1 month ago, Bousselle was selected for promotion to the rank of sergeant because of his heroic performance and leadership during invasions on Tulagi, Gavutu, Guadalcanal, and Cape Gloucester. Footnote: the American military campaign in the Pacific followed a strategy known as island hopping. The U.S. Navy, Army, and Marine Corps invaded Japanese island strongholds in the Pacific, slowly working their way north toward an eventual invasion of Japan. Islands not deemed vital to the advance were bypassed. End footnote. Now, as the Amtrak churns forward through the flat surf toward Peleliu, Bousselle buckles the chin strap of his steel helmet. The landing craft stalls momentarily on the coral reef 100 yards offshore, then continues churning toward the landing zone. Bousselle is tempted to peer up and over the side to glimpse the battlefield, but he keeps his head down. Japanese snipers are known to target the curious. All at once, geysers of water erupt around the landing craft. Incoming Japanese 141mm mortar rounds fill the air. Many find their mark, killing Bousselle's fellow Marines on other landing craft. The explosions and the roar of artillery are so loud that Bousselle and his squadmates cannot hear one another without yelling. The smoke of battle has turned the blue morning sky black. On any other day, Peleliu is a tropical island paradise. Today, it is a living hell. "Hit the beach!" yells a sergeant as the Amtrak steel treads reach the shore. Bousselle vaults up and over the side, landing hard on the bone-white sand and coral. The staccato chatter of hidden Japanese machine guns forces Bousselle to press his body flat against the earth. All around him, explosions bring flashes of light. The palm trees lining the beach are in flames. Crimson pools of American blood mingle with the yellow phosphorus of Japanese incendiary devices. All any man could do was sweat it out and pray for survival. One Marine will later write of his first moments on Peleliu. It would have been sure suicide to stand up during that firestorm. Everything Bousselle sees and hears gives the lie to what he and his fellow Marines had been told about this tactically vital Japanese stronghold. In preparation for Operation Stalemate, the United States Navy bombarded Peleliu with 10 days of aerial raids and 2 more days of naval shelling. It seemed impossible that anyone could have lived through such an intense barrage of napalm and artillery. "We have run out of targets," a top naval officer complained. American intelligence supported this notion, suggesting that the enemy response would be minimal. The Marine Corps officer commanding the invasion, Major General William Rupertus, predicted a quick and easy battle. "A hard-fought quickie that will last 4 days, 5 at most." But as Corporal Louis Bousselle and his squad can now attest, Peleliu will not be taken easily. Its defenders have had months to prepare. Mortar launchers and artillery are concealed behind the 2,200-yard beachfront, targeted to strike the precise spots at which the Americans now race ashore. In addition, the Japanese have constructed anti-tank barriers, laid hundreds of mines, and lined the beach with every coil of barbed wire in the Caroline Islands. Spider traps, the machine gun nests made of coconut tree logs, are camouflaged so well that they are almost invisible in the swampy landscape where jungle meets the sand. Yet Japanese Commander Colonel Kunio Nakagawa is a realist. He knows the Americans will eventually work their way ashore. The U.S. force is huge, so the wily colonel is employing a strategy tried just once before in the war. Despite the horrific welcome the Americans are now receiving, it is not his goal to win this battle on the beaches. Just a fraction of his army now fights the Marines, but thousands of other elite troops wait inland in a network of 500 hidden caves in the nearby Umerbrugal Highlands. Footnote. The concept of endurance engagements, as opposed to decisive engagements as a means of fighting a protracted defensive battle to wear down the Americans, was initially used on the small island of Biak off the western coast of New Guinea. It was unsuccessful there. The Japanese were annihilated during the battle, losing 6,100 soldiers. The soldiers of the U.S. Army's 41st Division, most of whom hailed from Oregon and Montana, earned the nickname the Jungleers for their success in the dense rainforests. They lost fewer than 500 men. End footnote. These Fukaku defenses will allow Nakagawa and his men to counter the Americans, bleeding them white by coming out of hiding to attack when the Marines least expect it. The attacking Japanese soldiers' ability to swarm out of nowhere led top British General William Slim to refer to them as the most formidable fighting insect in history. The men of Nakagawa's 14th Imperial Division embody that sentiment. Almost all are veteran warriors, hardened by years of battle. They have been living five stories underground, subsisting on a simple diet of rice and fish, and enduring the beatings and harsh discipline from their officers that are typical of the Japanese army. "You could be beaten for anything," one Japanese soldier later remembered. "Being too short or being too tall, even because somebody didn't like the way you drank coffee." This was done to make each man respond instantly to orders, and it produced results. If you want soldiers who fight hard, they must train hard. These soldiers have been taught another crucial lesson, that the Japanese race is superior to all others, and that triumph over the inferior Americans is inevitable. That is a lie. But to soldiers of the Imperial Japanese Army, it doesn't matter. Their strongest belief of all is in the Samurai Code of Bushido, which stipulates that surrender is a form of dishonor. "The man who would not disgrace himself must be strong," reads a line from the Japanese Army's Senjinkun, a pocket-sized code of behavior issued to all servicemen. "Do not survive in shame as a prisoner. Die to ensure that you do not leave ignominy behind you." Therein lies the basis for Colonel Nakagawa's trap. There is no escape route for the Japanese, no evacuation plan. The 46-year-old Nakagawa, who was decorated 9 times for his heroism during Japan's earlier war with China, has already informed his wife that he will never see her again. Soon, very soon, he will lure the unsuspecting Americans into the Umerbrugal Highlands and slaughter them. But in turn, he and his men will also be slaughtered. Surrender is not an option. Corporal Louis Bossel rises up off the sand and sprints in a low crouch. His goal is the protective shelter of a small coral ridge 100 yards inland. All around him as he runs, shouts of, "Get the hell off the beach!" mingle with desperate pleas of, "Corman!" Bossel has never seen such destruction. 200 Marines will die today. Hundreds more will be wounded. Terrified corporals and privates now watch the bodies of their brother Marines torn apart as fire from Japanese heavy artillery crashes down. One figure seemed to fly to pieces, a Marine will recall of a particularly grisly death. "With terrible clarity, I saw the head and one leg fly into the air. I saw a wounded Marine near me staggering," another American will remember. "His face was half bloody pulp, and the mangled shreds of what was left of an arm hung down like a stick. He fell behind me, in a red puddle on the white sand." Every man here knows what the Japanese army does to prisoners of war. Rather than hold men captive, the Japanese murder them in the most heinous fashion. Veterans of previous battles with this enemy have seen the corpses of Marines unlucky enough to be taken alive. Some had their bodies roped to a tree and used for live bayonet practice. Some had their heads, arms, and legs chopped off. Scores of U.S. Marines were emasculated with bayonets as they lay dying on the ground. "It was kill or be killed," Marine Corps Private Dan Lawler will later remember. "The Japs didn't take prisoners, so we didn't take prisoners either." Or, as Marine Corps Colonel Lewis Chesty Puller ordered his men before the Peleliu invasion, "You will take no prisoners. You will kill every yellow son of a bitch, and that's it." It seems an eternity, but it is only an hour before Corporal Bossel and a few of his fellow Marines manage to get off the sand. Bossel's smile has been replaced by a tight-lipped glare. His instincts sharpened by his many previous landings, Bossel searches the tree line for signs of hidden enemy machine gun emplacements targeting the invasion force. Suddenly, a burst of light gets Corporal Bossel's attention. The Japanese machine guns fire tracer bullets to help them zero in on a target, but these illuminated rounds can also help the Marines pinpoint the shooter's precise location. Bossel sees a stream of tracers emerging from a small cave with a commanding view of the beach. The entrance is concealed by scrub plants and thick brush. Taking charge of the squad, he motions for his men to follow him toward the cave's location. Reaching the cave first, he fires into a small opening. Lieutenant Jack Kimball of Greenville, Mississippi, arrives with a two-man flamethrower team. A stream of fire is launched into the Japanese position in the hope of forcing the enemy to come out. Corporal Bossel, meanwhile, stands ready to shoot them as they emerge. The first Japanese to run screaming from the cave is carrying a grenade. He pulls the pin before Bossel can fire his M1 carbine. Not only does the explosion kill the Japanese soldier, but shrapnel slices into several nearby Marines. More flame is shot into the cave. Another Japanese soldier emerges. This time, Bossel shoots him dead. Yet another Japanese soldier runs out of the cave, choosing the sure death by rifle fire to being roasted alive. He, too, carries a grenade, hurling it at the Americans as Bossel raises his weapon. The grenade is launched before Bossel shoots. It lands near him and several other Marines. The blast may kill them all. Without hesitation, Corporal Bossel throws his body onto the grenade. His torso rises off the ground as it explodes, smothering the blast. None of his fellow Marines is hurt. "Get that Jap!" Bossel shouts. Somehow, he is still alive. The flamethrower team shoots off a burst of flame, turning the Japanese soldier into a human torch. Less than 2 hours after landing on Peleliu, Corporal Lewis Bossel is put on a stretcher and carried back down the beach. He is loaded aboard an Amtrak, then ferried out to the hospital ship Bountiful, where he is immediately taken into surgery. But doctors cannot stop the bleeding. The Japanese grenade has sent deadly shards of metal deep into Bossel's internal organs. On September 18, 1944, 3 days after the invasion of Peleliu, Corporal Lewis Bossel dies. Unlike those of soldiers fighting on World War II's European front, his body will not be lowered into the ground and marked with a monument so that his family might someday visit. Instead, his corpse is wrapped in sailcloth, tethered to a spent artillery shell, and dropped at sea. Corporal Lewis Bossel is the first United States Marine at the Battle of Peleliu whose death will see him awarded America's highest award for valor, the Medal of Honor, for actions above and beyond the call of duty in combat. He is not the last. 2. Leyte, Visayas Islands, Philippines, October 20th, 1944. 1300 hours. General Douglas MacArthur is grinning. "As Ripley says, believe it or not, we're here," he boasts to his chief of staff. 700 miles west of Peleliu, where Marines are now mired in their fifth bloody week of combat, the 64-year-old commander of American forces in the Pacific leans over the rail of the USS Nashville. Footnote: 2 months after MacArthur's landing, Japanese kamikaze aircraft flew into the Nashville. The light cruiser remained afloat but suffered the loss of 133 sailors and an additional 190 wounded in the fiery explosions. End footnote. He gazes into the distance at his beloved Philippines, which were invaded by more than 100,000 U.S. Army troops under his command less than 4 hours ago. His counterpart in Europe, General Dwight Eisenhower, became famous for the D-Day invasion of France this past June. So MacArthur, well known for his ego, has chosen to call the date of this invasion A-Day, for Attack Day. Footnote. At the time, the invasion of Leyte was the second largest amphibious landing of the Second World War, next to that of Normandy. Leyte was unique in that the American soldiers had to travel 4,000 miles by ship, a distance greater than the width of the United States, in order to launch their invasion. The distance from England to Normandy was roughly 20 miles. End footnote. As on Peleliu, intelligence reports predicting minimal enemy resistance have proven very wrong. The Japanese are putting up a fierce fight for the Philippines. Even miles out to sea, MacArthur can hear the chatter of automatic weapons fire coming from groves of palm trees and see the billowing plumes of black smoke from the jungle. Just overhead, American fighter bombers buzz toward entrenched enemy positions, keeping a sharp eye out for Japanese Zero fighter planes. 2 years ago, after the fall of the Philippines to the Japanese, the most humiliating defeat of MacArthur's storied career, the general promised the world that he would one day come back in glory to retake the islands. Now he is setting out to make good on that vow. Douglas MacArthur, who likes to refer to himself in the third person as simply MacArthur, is a shade over 6 feet tall, the son of a Medal of Honor-winning general through whom he has a lifelong connection to the Philippines. Arthur MacArthur Jr. fought in the American Civil War as a teenager and, after the Spanish-American War, served as military governor of the Philippines. Footnote. Arthur MacArthur Jr. was just 18 when he rallied Union troops during the pivotal Battle of Missionary Ridge outside Chattanooga on November 25, 1863. The son of a former Wisconsin governor, MacArthur rushed to the top of the hill during thick fighting, planting the regimental colors of the 24th Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry Regiment on the summit and shouting, "On, Wisconsin!" as he did so. End footnote. Douglas graduated at the top of his class at West Point and to this day is as narrow-waisted and fit as on his commissioning day in 1903. MacArthur clambers down a ladder hanging over the Nashville's side and into a waiting landing craft. As he does every day, the general wears a freshly pressed khaki uniform that bears no insignia or ribbons. He fastidiously maintains the creases on his shirt sleeves and trousers by changing clothes frequently and has just donned a fresh uniform for the landing. In case the landing goes horribly wrong and MacArthur is at risk of being taken prisoner, a loaded Derringer that once belonged to his father rests in his hip pocket. Sweat stains seep into the gold braiding encircling MacArthur's weathered field marshal's cap. His dark brown eyes are shielded from the ocean's glare by wire-rimmed Ray-Ban sunglasses. Completing these trademark aspects of his appearance, all of which have made the general an iconic figure worldwide, is the unlit corncob pipe clenched firmly between his teeth. Footnote. MacArthur's pipes were made to his precise specifications by the Missouri Meerschaum Company, which continues to sell a replica of his deep, bold, long-stemmed pipe. Similarly, Ray-Ban named a line of sunglasses in the general's honor in 1987. End footnote. Chief of Staff Richard Sutherland, a lieutenant general, follows MacArthur down the ladder. After the remainder of MacArthur's Bataan gang descend into the landing craft, a select group of war correspondents joins them. Douglas MacArthur knows the value of good publicity and has carefully choreographed his landing so that images of this great moment will soon be splashed across front pages around the world. The plan is to land not on the beach, but at a dock. The photographers will step out of the boat first, then turn around to capture the immaculately starched and pressed general once again setting foot on Philippine soil. Like many a scripted moment, however, the actual event will unfold in a quite different fashion. Almost 1,000 days after fleeing the Philippines, General Douglas MacArthur orders the landing craft to sail for shore. He has returned. Douglas MacArthur well knows that this landing in the Philippines is a vital step toward the eventual invasion of Japan. Though plans are still in the conceptual phase, and such an assault is at least a year away, it promises to be the greatest amphibious landing in history. It is expected that hundreds of thousands of American soldiers, marines, pilots, and sailors will take part on a scale dwarfing that of the D-Day landings in Normandy. The cost will be extreme. Loss of life is expected to approach 1 million on both sides. As the most revered general in the Pacific, MacArthur will most assuredly be called upon to lead this devastating invasion. Yet, were it not for a direct order 4 years ago from President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a man whom MacArthur tolerates rather than admires, the general wouldn't be under consideration for such a glorious command. Indeed, he would most likely be starving to death in a prisoner of war camp. Footnote: MacArthur is a right-wing Republican whose political philosophy does not line up with that of the liberal Roosevelt. End footnote. It was December 7, 1941, when the Japanese launched a surprise attack on the American fleet moored at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Blindsided by violence on this date which will live in infamy, America declared war on Japan and its ally Germany. Following the sneak attack, the Japanese quickly struck again 1 day later and more than 5,000 miles west across the open Pacific. Shortly after noon, a flight of Japanese fighter bombers from the 11th Air Fleet destroyed the American airbase at Clark Field in the Philippines. 2 days later, two more waves of Japanese aircraft flew unopposed over the Cavite Navy Yard, laying waste to the docks. The U.S. destroyers Pillsbury and Perry barely escaped, and the submarine Sea Lion was bombed in her berth. As with the attack on Clark Field, the Japanese chose to drop their bombs on Cavite just after noon. Incredibly, 2 short days after the shock of Pearl Harbor, many of America's defenders were still not on full alert and were at lunch as the raids began. But the Philippine Islands were different than Pearl Harbor. Their location is much closer to Japan, making possession of them a much more urgent tactical necessity. Capturing the Philippines would effectively give Japan control of the Western Pacific. Rather than conduct a savage aerial bombardment, the forces of Dai Nippon, or Great Japan, aimed to seize control of the entire country. Footnote: Dai Nippon refers to the assemblage of islands and colonies under Japanese control at the outset of World War II. The usage is similar to the term Great Britain, the name of another island nation dependent on colonies and conquests as a source of empire. End footnote. The invasion was planned for almost a decade, beginning with an influx of Japanese soldiers disguised as immigrants, a systematic mapping of the Philippines' more than 7,000 islands, and spying on Philippine coastal defenses. Only later, Filipino President Manuel Quezon will remember, did I discover that my gardener was a Japanese major and my masseur a Japanese colonel. At the apex of American leadership in the Philippines at the time was Douglas MacArthur. He and his wife Jean lived with their 3-year-old son Arthur in an opulent penthouse atop the Manila Hotel. MacArthur had left the U.S. Army in 1937 after a brilliant career, then accepted a high-paying position as a field marshal in the Philippine Army. But he was recalled in July 1941 as war began to appear imminent and named commander of American forces in the Far East. He was the obvious choice for the position. Not only had he lived in the strategically vital Philippines during the 1920s and 1930s, he had overseen the creation of the Philippine Army. Footnote: in addition, MacArthur's list of accomplishments and battle commands during his long military career would have made it ludicrous for any other general to assume this post. His passion for the Pacific way of life extended to the Orient. He often relaxed wearing a Japanese kimono. End footnote. Within a matter of months after Japanese bombing destroyed his air force on the ground, MacArthur's small army was powerless against invasion. Fleeing Manila, MacArthur retreated to fortified positions on the Bataan Peninsula, where he assured his men that reinforcements were on the way. But this was not true. American and British policy dictated that most resources be spent on defeating Germany before Japan. Footnote. The Arcadia Conference, a summit between British and American leaders in Washington, D.C. during December 1941 and January 1942, led to the Europe First strategy. While the United States and Britain worked closely together to defeat Germany, the British role in the Pacific theater was focused on General William Slim's victories in Burma. The battle against Japan in the last year of the war was largely an American enterprise. End footnote. Even if that were not the case, the remote location of the Philippines and the Japanese naval domination of the Pacific meant that reinforcements wouldn't get through in time. President Roosevelt, upon hearing MacArthur's promise, called his words criminal. For the next 2 months, the Japanese continued their advance. The small American and Filipino forces under MacArthur's command were pushed back to the tip of the Bataan Peninsula, where many took refuge in a fortress on an island known as Corregidor. Even when it became clear that Bataan and Corregidor would soon fall, MacArthur directed the resistance from the safety of his underground bunker in the bomb-proof Malinta Tunnel. His desperate battle became a symbol of resistance to the Japanese onslaught throughout the Pacific, and MacArthur was largely portrayed as a hero in the media, making him world famous. It soon became clear to President Roosevelt that he had to rescue MacArthur. He had no choice. America was stunned by its sudden immersion into war. The Japanese seemed unbeatable. Allowing Douglas MacArthur to become a prisoner of war would have devastated national morale. On February 22nd, Roosevelt ordered MacArthur to flee. The Navy spirited his family and 20 of his staff, along with his son's Chinese nanny, out of the Philippines on swift patrol torpedo PT boats. Some felt that the nanny, with the unlikely name of Ah Chu, should be replaced by an army nurse, but MacArthur was adamant that she come along. All told, the group, allowed one suitcase each, would undertake a 600-mile voyage in 4 PT boats, traveling over the open ocean in hopes of making it to the island of Mindanao. The remainder of MacArthur's American and Filipino soldiers on Bataan and Corregidor were left behind under the command of Lieutenant General Jonathan Skinny Wainwright. Thus, two parallel odysseys began. The defenders of Bataan and Corregidor endured a descent into hell. Bataan fell first in April 1942. In what would become known as the Bataan Death March, 76,000 captured American and Filipino soldiers were stripped of their valuables and force-marched 65 miles to a prison camp. Their hands were bound the entire way. Those unable to keep pace in the brutal heat and humidity were shot, bayoneted, or beheaded by their captors. Japanese trucks rolled right over those who collapsed. In all, more than 7,000 men perished. Corregidor fell 1 month later. General Wainwright and his remaining men were placed in prison camps, where the ritual abuse and murder of Americans by the Japanese army would continue for the next 3.5 years. Throughout the war, the forces of the emperor would turn their American prisoners into slaves. Living conditions in their concentration camps were deplorable, and men died from dysentery, beriberi, and starvation. General Wainwright, already a very thin man at the outset of the war, became skeletal during his captivity. He was nominated for the Medal of Honor while still in a Japanese prison camp, but Douglas MacArthur objected to the request, stating that Wainwright should never have surrendered. Footnote. General George C. Marshall put forth Wainwright's name for the Medal of Honor on July 30, 1942. MacArthur, still stinging from the surrender of Corregidor, openly opposed the nomination, an act unheard of in the history of the award. In a letter to Marshall, MacArthur wrote, As a relative matter, award of the Medal of Honor to General Wainwright would be a grave injustice to a number of general officers of practically equally responsible positions who not only distinguished themselves by fully as great personal gallantry, thereby earning the DSC, but exhibited powers of leadership and inspiration to a degree greatly superior to that of General Wainwright, thereby contributing much more to the stability of the command and to the successful conduct of the campaign. It would be a grave mistake, which later on might well lead to embarrassing repercussions, to make this award. Marshall rescinded the nomination. Wainwright never held a grudge toward MacArthur, whom he considered a dear friend and great general. Upon his release from a Japanese prisoner of war camp at war's end, Wainwright was treated like a national hero and honored with a ticker tape parade in New York. On September 10, 1945, he was finally awarded the Medal of Honor. End footnote. Meanwhile, MacArthur's journey eventually led him to Australia, where he assumed command of all forces in the Pacific. Many Americans saw his escape from Corregidor as an act of daring, but some considered the desertion of his men an act of cowardice. MacArthur explained his actions to reporters while in Australia. "The President of the United States ordered me to break through the Japanese lines and proceed from Corregidor to Australia for the purpose, as I understand it, of organizing the American offensive against Japan, a primary objective of which is the relief of the Philippines. I came through, and I shall return." On April 1, 1942, Douglas MacArthur was awarded the Medal of Honor for conspicuous leadership in his heroic defense of the Philippines, making MacArthur and General Arthur MacArthur, Jr. the first father-son Medal of Honor winners in American history. Footnote. Teddy Roosevelt and his son Theodore III were the second such pair. End footnote. So it is that island by island, men under MacArthur's command are retaking control of the Pacific as the general works his way back to the Philippines. His desire to redeem himself trumps all other motives and has drawn critique from Navy commanders. Footnote. Admirals Ernest King and Chester Nimitz believed retaking the islands was not a priority and that they could be bypassed altogether. They felt MacArthur was too emotionally attached to the Philippines to view them with a critical strategic eye. Even General George Marshall, MacArthur's superior in Washington, cautioned him, "We must be careful not to allow our personal feeling to override our great objective, which is the early conclusion of the war with Japan. Bypassing is not synonymous with abandonment." MacArthur refused to change his pro-invasion stance and ultimately won the argument in the summer of 1944. End footnote. The devastating battle for Peleliu, which has already incurred 4,000 American casualties, is taking place only because MacArthur fears that Japanese planes will launch from its runways and harass his Philippine invasion force. In truth, the American Navy now controls the sea and the skies and would have little trouble stopping an aerial attack. It has taken MacArthur almost 3 years, but his landing craft finally arrives at Red Beach on Leyte. The general's face hardens as he steps off the boat into knee-deep ocean water, the razor-sharp creases in his pants disappearing in an instant. "Let him walk!" barked the Navy officer in charge of directing the traffic of landing barges moving on and off of Red Beach when he heard that MacArthur wanted a special dock on which to land. A beachmaster, as this officer is known, enjoys supreme authority over the landing zone. Not even the great Douglas MacArthur receives special treatment. It is 40 paces from the landing craft to shore. MacArthur glares at the impertinent young officer as he wades through the flat surf. His personal photographer, Captain Gaetano Failassi, captures the moment for posterity, even as the Japanese snipers roped high up in the palm trees could very well be taking aim at the 64-year-old general standing tall on the white sand. Once on land, MacArthur is handed a microphone. "People of the Philippines," he proclaims, "I have returned." In his excitement, the normally imperturbable general's hands shake. Soon after, General Douglas MacArthur turns around and wades back to his landing craft, which quickly returns him to the shelter and safety of the USS Nashville. 3. Kansas City, Missouri, November 3, 1944, 9 p.m.
I have long since become immune to mudslinging and find the best tactics are to ignore it, Harry Truman writes in a letter to his friend J.L. Naylor as his campaign train pulls into Kansas City. The 60-year-old Truman drains his glass of old granddad bourbon and sets it on the writing table. The great locomotive that has pulled him around America glides into the city's Union Station, bringing the Democratic vice presidential candidate's month-long barnstorming tour to an end. Despite Truman's hard work, the war has garnered more front-page news than his speeches and rallies, and with good reason. Almost 8,000 miles away in the Pacific, Peleliu has become a ghastly mess, with thousands of Marines killed and wounded. In the Philippines, General Douglas MacArthur's hopes for an easy victory have been dashed by a determined enemy, poor strategic planning, and something new, the kamikaze. Japanese suicide pilots dropping out of the sky to sink American ships by deliberately flying their planes into the hulls. Tonight, Harry Truman will sleep in a luxury hotel rather than the train's cramped berth, knowing that he has done all he can to help elect President Franklin Roosevelt to a fourth term in office. In the morning, as he sometimes prefers, Truman may toast the journey's end with a breakfast shot of old granddad. The night air is chill and smells of rain. Truman, his wife Bess, and their daughter Margaret step down onto the platform. The vice presidential candidate adores Bess and proves it by writing long love letters to her when he is away. On June 28th, they celebrated 25 years of marriage. Margaret Truman is a student at George Washington University who aspires to a singing career. She is the couple's only child. Margaret is not exceptionally beautiful, but possesses an honesty and intelligence common among those secure in their own skin. In these ways, she is much like her father. A car waits for the Truman family. The driver watches as their luggage is loaded. The potential vice president is glad to finally be back in Kansas City. Since Truman was first elected to the Senate in 1934, his family has divided their time between Washington and his home state of Missouri. This is where his political career began more than 20 years ago, so it is fitting that his campaign should end here. There will be one final speech tomorrow evening here in town, and then Truman can do little but wait for Election Day, when he may be elected Vice President of the United States, replacing Henry Wallace. Footnote. While he was popular with the far left, Wallace's communist sympathies were well known. Roosevelt publicly endorsed him as his vice president before the 1944 Democratic Convention, but was pressed to see a replacement by party leaders who worried that he might die in office. Truman, the dark horse choice due to his outspoken nature, was seen as a better successor to lead America into the post-war world. In the end, FDR acceded to the demands of some Democratic power brokers who wanted Wallace off the ticket. End footnote. Truman is confident of victory. Franklin Roosevelt's overwhelming popularity and steely leadership during the Second World War has seen him elected a record 3 times. Now, with the war in Europe seemingly won and the battles in the Pacific slowly turning against the Japanese, the public continues in its support of the patrician Democrat. FDR's opponent in the election of 1944 is the Republican Thomas Dewey, the diminutive governor of New York with the fuller brush mustache. Dewey likes to attack Roosevelt as a communist with unsound domestic policies. Although simplistic, Dewey's assertions elicit resounding ovations wherever he campaigns. In truth, America loves Franklin Roosevelt like a trusted rich uncle. Dewey and his running mate, Ohio Governor John W. Bricker, have campaigned with an underdog's zeal, but they have no chance at victory. Support for Roosevelt is just too strong. Footnote. The Roosevelt-Truman ticket won the election in a landslide over the Republican ticket of Thomas Dewey and John W. Bricker. The final Electoral College tally was 432-99. End footnote. The same cannot be said of Harry Truman. America knows nothing about him. The Republicans have made his anonymity a campaign issue, warning that the untested Truman would lead the nation if Roosevelt were to die. Even the media agree. The hind half of the ticket is a storm center, exciting almost as much debate as the standard bearer himself, wrote the New York Times in early October. The competence of Mr. Roosevelt's current running mate is the nearest thing this country has to a burning issue. The Chicago Tribune is just as direct, stating that Senator Truman is a newcomer. We ought to know more about him, and the best way to learn is from his own lips. But Harry S. Truman is nothing if not discreet. Footnote. The S stands for nothing. Truman's parents were torn between using the family names of Solomon or Ship as a middle name. In the end, they could not decide and simply used the S. Common in Roman times, middle names fell out of favor for more than 1,000 years. In America, middle names made a resurgence after the Civil War, but were not standard practice until after World War I. Many of America's founding fathers, including George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin, had no middle name. End footnote. Stoicism in the face of controversy requires the same chin-up attitude that made him successful as an artillery officer in France during World War I, and allowed him to rise through the political ranks. The polio that has put the president in a wheelchair, combined with his passion for gin and cigarettes, is hardening his arteries and dulling his thoughts. But Harry Truman does not know FDR well enough to comment on the president's condition. Presidential politics are a ruthless business, so Truman volunteers little about himself during his 4-week train campaign from Atlantic to Pacific and back again. Even an oversight can be blown up by the media. 3 weeks ago, at a speech at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, Truman unknowingly endorsed a former member of the Ku Klux Klan for Congress. Republicans immediately pounced. Rumors arose that Truman himself was a member of the white supremacist group. "Of course I'm not a member of the Klan," Truman barked when a Chicago reporter questioned him 2 weeks later. And still the innuendo would not disappear. On October 30th, one night before Truman greeted a crowd of 20,000 at New York's Madison Square Garden, fabled actress Gloria Swanson spoke on the radio in an address paid for by the Republican National Committee, making accusations about Mr. Truman's membership in the Ku Klux Klan. Although he was furious, Harry Truman offered no response. It was not until leading members of the black community stated, "Mr. Truman is a friend of the Negro people, a true progressive," that the baseless rumors slowly abated. Footnote. Truman had long been a public proponent of civil rights for black Americans. The quote comes from an editorial in The People's Voice, a Harlem, New York newspaper founded by civil rights leader Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. In addition, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, came to Truman's defense. End footnote. Harry Truman's driver drops the Truman family at the Muehlbach Hotel at the intersection of 12th and Baltimore. Ernest Hemingway once stayed here. So did Bob Hope, Babe Ruth, and Helen Keller. In time, the Beatles will party in its corridors. At this point in his life, Harry S. Truman knows no such celebrity. Bellmen scramble for the Truman's luggage. Unlike General Douglas MacArthur, who hasn't opened a door for himself or carried his own suitcase for years, the ever-practical Truman is self-sufficient. During his train ride around America, he washed his socks between stops and hung them outside the window to dry. Stepping into the lobby of the Muehlbach, he is quick to thank the doorman. Now, Bess and Margaret at his side, Harry Truman can finally rest. Or so he thinks. 4. Umerbrugal Pocket, Peleliu, Caroline Islands, November 24, 1944, 1100 hours. Colonel Kunio Nakagawa kneels in the cave that has served as his command post for more than 2 months. The short, razor-sharp blade of a tantao is clutched in his right fist. Nakagawa has inflicted more than 10,000 casualties on the Americans, more than any other Japanese officer in the war. His strategy of retreating into an underground fortress to fight a defensive battle has terrified the Americans. Unable to dig deep foxholes in the coral that covers so much of the island, the Marines lie exposed, easy targets for sniper fire or nighttime stealth attacks. Often, Nakagawa's men will quietly leave their cave networks to kill any American who makes the cardinal error of falling asleep while on watch. Nakagawa's soldiers can often smell their victims before actually laying eyes on them. The Americans are unable to bury their excrement or take a simple shower, resulting in a stench of human waste and tang of sweat-soaked uniforms that has only been intensified by the searing island heat. Even more aromatic is the smell of Japanese and American corpses left to rot in the sun, the bloated skin of the dead men covered in giant blowflies. All of this is the handiwork of Colonel Nakagawa. Almost all of his soldiers are dead now. The Americans have pressed their attack despite the enormous loss of life. They have aimed flamethrowers into the caves to burn men alive and exploded the caves with artillery and hand grenades, entombing Nakagawa's warriors forever. Once upon a time, Nakagawa commanded the entire island. Now his redoubt is just a few hundred meters wide. The time has come to do what he needs to do so as not to disgrace himself. Already, Nakagawa has set fire to his regimental colors so that they will never fall into American hands. He has proclaimed to his remaining 56 emaciated soldiers that "our sword is broken and we have run out of spears," as he divided them into small groups. He then ordered the men to fan out deep in the caves and attack the Americans, fighting to the very end. Footnote: the last of Nakagawa's soldiers eluded capture until April 22, 1947. End footnote. If necessary, Nakagawa was prepared to act as kaishakunin for his superior officer, Major General Kenjiro Mirai. Unknown to the U.S. Marines, Mirai has been on Peleliu throughout the invasion. His job has been to make sure Nakagawa does not make any mistakes, as one Japanese soldier will admit to the Americans when he is taken prisoner. Nakagawa has now seen the tables turn. Where he was once watched over by Mirai, now it has been his job to make sure that Mirai did not lose heart when the moment to commit ritual suicide was upon him. As Mirai's kaishakunin, or second, it would be Nakagawa's role to stand by and help Mirai with his sword, prepared to assist in the general's death should Mirai no longer be able to control the knife with which he is committing seppuku. But Mirai has completed the task. He lies dead, intestines spilling from his body onto the command post's coral floor. Nakagawa watched as the general knelt, then plunged the tanto into the left side of his abdomen. Mirai then wrenched the blade sharply to the right, slicing through the soft belly skin. Blood and internal organs spilled from the gash in a torrent. Mirai writhed in agony as he fell forward. Death came for him in less than 30 seconds. The 46-year-old Colonel Nakagawa now kneels down beside his dead commander, praying for the same courage to end his life with honor. The Marines have fought gallantly on Peleliu for 2 months, displaying the depth of their training and their commitment to one another. Corporal Louis Bossel was the first to give his life for his brother Marines. 7 others will be awarded the Medal of Honor for conspicuous courage under fire, 4 of whom also threw themselves on live grenades to save the lives of their brothers. Footnote: the other recipients of the Medal of Honor were 1st Lieutenant Carlton Robert Rue, Private 1st Class Charles Howard Roan, Captain Everett Parker Pope, Private Wesley Phelps, Private 1st Class John Dury New, Private 1st Class Richard Edward Krause, and Private 1st Class Arthur J. Jackson. End footnote. On September 18th, the same day that saw the death of Corporal Bossel, Private First Class Arthur J. Jackson of Cleveland, Ohio, single-handedly attacks a thick cement pillbox containing 35 Japanese soldiers. Even as he takes heavy fire, Jackson pokes the barrel of his M1 into a narrow gun opening and squeezes off a round. He then hurls white phosphorus grenades inside the bunker, killing everyone inside. Spotting two similar pillboxes nearby, Jackson storms them alone, with the same unlikely result. But PFC Jackson is not finished. Identifying each and every one of the hidden Japanese machine gun nests, the square-jawed 19-year-old dashes from emplacement to emplacement, killing each and every soldier who is shooting at him. He stormed one gun position after another, dealing death and destruction to the savagely fighting enemy in his inexorable drive against the remaining defenses, and succeeded in wiping out a total of 12 pillboxes and 50 Japanese soldiers, Jackson's Medal of Honor citation will read. When his one-man offensive comes to an end, the 19-year-old Marine collapses from heat exhaustion. It is a moment Jackson will long remember. I felt like I was a ball player that had just made the winning touchdown. Footnote: Arthur J. Jackson received his Medal of Honor at a White House ceremony on October 5, 1945. In 1961, having attained the rank of captain, he fatally shot a Cuban spy at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Fearing an international incident due to the strained relations between Cuba and the United States, Jackson attempted to conceal the death by burying the body. Jackson was found out, however, and lost his commission. End footnote. One day later, it is Captain Everett P. Pope who demonstrates the Corps' grit. Captain of the tennis team while at Bowdoin College, where he was elected to Phi Beta Kappa and graduated magna cum laude, the 25-year-old Bostonian is also a fluent speaker of French, a loving husband, and the father of two young sons. But that was before the war, in another life. Since first seeing action at Guadalcanal in June 1942, Pope has become a trained killer and leader of men. During the New Britain campaign earlier this year, he led a 14-man squad into thick jungle in search of Japanese positions. Not only did his men kill 20 of the enemy, but Pope performed the almost impossible feat of bringing back 7 Japanese prisoners for interrogation. Now, with Peleliu's airfield in American hands, the Marines face the daunting task of moving inland to flush the enemy from their caves in the Immergal Ridges. Company Commander Pope is ordered to take Hill 154, a sheer coral outcrop on a slope known as Suicide Ridge. Pope and his men are already exhausted. Since landing on Peleliu 4 days ago, his company has suffered 30% casualties. The loss of trained riflemen has forced Pope to utilize cooks and bakers and company clerks on the line. It is dawn as they prepare to attack, but few have slept, as the Japanese sent soldiers out in the night to infiltrate the American lines. They are thirsty, for the equatorial heat is relentless, never dipping below 100 degrees, even at night. Coral tears their clothing, cuts through their boots, and is heated by the sun, burning their skin on contact. The 3-pound steel helmets protecting their heads from shrapnel also serve as pillow, cookpot, and latrine. Many choose not to wear underwear or a t-shirt due to the heat and are not likely to change their socks for days at a time, if at all. The water with which they fill their canteens is rust-colored and tastes like gasoline because the Navy has stored the water in 55-gallon drums that once stored fuel. The Marines desperately need to drink, but the water makes them nauseated. And yet they must attack. Pope gives the order to advance. The company approaches Hill 154 through a swamp, supported by mortar rounds and machine gun fire. In addition to the packs on their backs, each man carries a rifle, pistol, canteen, and ammunition. Immediately, the Japanese pop up out of the ground to let loose a stream of bullets before disappearing into their caves once again. Many of the shots are fired at point-blank range from the other side of the swamp. Pope and his Marine assault unit fall back. But Hill 154 must be taken. Hours later, the afternoon sun beating down on them, Pope's company attacks once more. His Marines are again overwhelmed by precise enemy fire and suffer horrific casualties. Pope's company numbered almost 235 men 4 days ago. By 1800 hours, as dusk falls on Hill 154, just 14 remain. But those 14 control the hill. Pope must now hold this position at all costs. Those are his orders. But he immediately recognizes that his position is tenuous. Hill 154 is barren and exposed on three sides, leaving Pope and his men open to enemy fire. His only option is to spread the two officers and 11 enlisted men in strategic positions across the top of the hill. The weapons at their disposal are few: Tommy guns, rifles, a light machine gun, and a small number of hand grenades. Pope's men are from Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Texas, Maine, Michigan, Kansas, California, and New York City. Now, as the sun sets and the utter blackness of the island night is upon them, fate has brought them all to the peak of Hill 154, the place they all might die. A crescent moon rises, a mere sliver in the sky. Pope and his soldiers cannot see the faces of the Japanese who now creep forward to kill them, many clad in black pajama-like uniforms. Nor can the Americans hear their enemy, for the Japanese wear split-toed shoes with a rubber sole that allow them to walk without a sound. At first, the Japanese are bold, attacking in ones and twos. But Pope's men's senses are heightened by the knowledge that any mistake will be their last. The Americans easily fend off the first teams of Japanese killers. Toward midnight, the strategy shifts. 25 enemy soldiers at a time creep in toward the American positions. One of them comes close enough to bayonet Second Lieutenant Francis T. Burke in the leg. Unable to reach his gun, Burke beats his assailant to a pulp with his fists and then throws the Japanese soldier off the side of a cliff. As the battle stretches into the early morning hours, many of Pope's men are wounded, but they still hold Hill 154. The Japanese begin shooting flares into the sky to light the American position, then letting loose salvos of small arms fire. The Americans respond with precise grenade throws that keep the enemy at bay. When the grenade supply runs low, they substitute rocks. "The Japs didn't know which were which," one Marine will later recall. "We would throw three or four rocks, then a grenade." When the Japanese respond by hurling grenades of their own, the Americans pick them up and throw them right back. With morning still hours away, the Americans run out of bullets and grenades. But they refuse to surrender. With no conventional weapons at their disposal, they fling empty ammunition boxes at the enemy. When the ammunition boxes are gone, the Marines use their bare fists. As sunrise limns the horizon, Pope is down to just 9 able-bodied Marines. Yet Hill 154 is still in American hands. Dawn offers Captain Pope and his men the hope that reinforcements will soon strengthen their tenuous position. Japanese dead lie everywhere around them, many just a few feet from the American positions. Pope's group has exhibited outstanding bravery. But it is all for naught. In the light of day, the Japanese are astonished to see just a handful of Americans without guns or grenades holding Hill 154. Within minutes, they assemble to descend en masse upon the Marines. "We could clearly see the Japanese forming up for a very heavy attack, 50 or 100 men," Pope will later remember. "At that point, we were ordered to withdraw, so we came tumbling down the hill." Captain Everett Pope will tell that story until the day he dies, 65 years later, at the age of 90. He and his men retreated to safety after that perilous night, then waited in frustration for the moment when American forces would once again attempt to capture Hill 154. For Captain Pope, the return was more personal than tactical. "The hill was not taken again for 10 or 11 or 12 days," Pope will add as he tells of that horrific night, "And it took that long for my dead on that hill to be buried. A lot of brave Marines died on that hill. I can never forget it." The battle for Hill 154 sets the tone for the next month of combat. The Americans attack, and the Japanese fight back from hidden fortifications. As Colonel Nakagawa envisioned when he oversaw the building of the Japanese cave network so many months ago, his strong defensive positions are almost impervious to the steady American assaults. After 3 weeks of battle, the Americans have seized almost all of Peleliu, including the all-important airfield, yet they still don't control Nakagawa's stronghold in the Immergal Pocket. And until it is taken, the Japanese can launch artillery fire at any American position on the island. Though just a quarter mile wide and three-quarters of a mile long, the mountain ridges of the Immergal Pocket are a killing zone like no other. Marine casualties run as high as 60%. Names like Five Sisters, Dead Man's Curve, and Bloody Nose Ridge join Suicide Ridge in Marine lore, never to be forgotten for the toll exacted by Nakagawa's soldiers. Death becomes so common that men have become calloused to the sight. "We passed several stacks of dead Marines," one American will later recall. "They were piled five one way and five the other way. The stacks were about 5 feet high." American F-4U Corsair fighter bombers take off regularly from the nearby airfield to bomb the Immergal Pocket with napalm, a liquid petroleum designed to burn the Japanese out of their caves. Its gelling agent sticks to the skin, making the fiery death it causes all the more painful. Once the pilots drop their payload, they return and strafe the ridgeline, their bullets igniting the napalm. The time from takeoff to when the Corsairs make their two passes and return to the airfield is just 5 minutes. So short that most pilots don't even retract their landing gear. But the enemy remains defiant. "The Japs weren't on the island. They were in the island," one Marine will marvel years later. "One cave was big enough to house about 1,500 Jap soldiers. This big cave started on one side of a ridge, went all the way under, and came out the other side. They had a dispensary set up there, a hospital, all kinds of stuff." Americans kept their heads down at all times, lest a Japanese sniper take aim. Captain Haldane peeked over the top of this ridge. Bang! One shot was fired. He was shot right through the forehead. It killed him immediately. One Marine will recall about the death of a beloved officer. The island smells of decomposition as dead bodies turn black and bloat in the sun. Land crabs feed on the corpses at night. Blowflies ingest so much flesh and blood that they become too heavy to fly. The stench of rotting food and diarrhea adds to the fetid odors. The heat is so great that artillery shells must be kept in the shade lest they explode. And merely killing Americans is not enough for the soldiers of the Imperial Japanese Army. As they did so often early in the war, they mutilate the bodies of dead Marines whenever they can, cutting off their penises and stuffing them into mouths yawned open by rigor mortis. Yet cave by cave, the Americans slowly take control of the Immergal Pocket. The tactics of conventional warfare are set aside. Napalm and flamethrowers flush the Japanese from their hiding places. For those who refuse to come out, explosives are used to seal the cave entrances, forever burying the Japanese soldiers within. And while the island's 11,000 defenders almost all perish, the cost in American lives is equally extraordinary. The 1st Marine Division suffers 6,500 casualties in 1 month of fighting. Midway through the Battle of Peleliu, they no longer constitute a vital fighting force. Despite having captured the island's most strategically important terrain, they are evacuated, replaced in combat by the 5th Marines and elements of the U.S. Army's 81st Infantry Division. Finally, the Immergal Pocket is declared secure. Peleliu has been captured. The battle that was supposed to last just 4 days has taken 12 weeks. In his underground command post, Colonel Nakagawa lies dead, his hand still clutching the short-bladed knife with which he committed ritual suicide. One day soon, his wife will learn that he has been posthumously promoted to Lieutenant General for his genius and courage. Footnote. The bodies of Colonel Nakagawa and Major General Murai would not be discovered for almost 40 years, at which time they were transported to Japan for burial. Colonel Nakagawa's wife lived to see the day her husband finally made his return home. End footnote. It has taken the Marines an average of 1,500 rounds of ammunition to kill just one Japanese soldier. More than 13 million bullets were fired by the Americans, along with 150,000 mortar rounds. The mental and physical toll on the Americans has been tremendous. I was wiped out after 30 days of constant fighting. Exhausted, mentally and physically. We all were, Private R.V. Bergen will remember. Everybody's clothes were ragged, frayed, torn. Shoes were just about gone. Everybody stunk. Nobody was changing his socks. There was a lot of diarrhea going on. We were a bunch of raggedy-ass Marines. For both American and Japanese military planners, Nakagawa's tactics provide the blueprint for all future island invasions. In all, his defensive style of battle has cost the Americans more than 15,000 casualties. Back in Washington, war strategists begin to ask one vital question. If the Japanese will fight with such determination over a small, remote island of little tactical significance, how many Americans will die when the time comes to invade the Japanese homeland? 5. Imperial Palace, Tokyo, Japan, November 24, 1944, noon. As Colonel Kunio Nakagawa commits ritual suicide in a dark Peleliu cave, the man to whom he prays for courage sits down for a lunch of dumpling soup and vegetables. In America, it is Thanksgiving, and President Franklin Roosevelt issues a special exhortation. He encourages citizens not just to give thanks, but to read their own version of Scripture every day between now and Christmas to ensure a renewed and strengthening contact with those eternal truths and majestic principles which have inspired such measure of true greatness as this nation has achieved. In Japan, sipping his soup, Emperor Michinomiya Hirohito does not give thanks to a god. He is a god. This short, shy, nearsighted 43-year-old is considered to be a descendant of the sun goddess Amaterasu, a Shinto religious deity. Hirohito's daily life, however, is far from transcendent. In fact, it is quite common. Though he lives in an enormous castle with its own forest and moat, he does not smoke or drink, and a litany of worries keep him up at all hours of the night. If the emperor really believes he is a god, he surely now knows that thousands of mortal men are looking to destroy him. The 124th emperor of Japan rises promptly at 7 o'clock each morning, then starts his day with oatmeal and a slice of black bread. He parts his black hair on the left, has a passion for marine biology, and has fathered 7 children with the distant cousin whom he married 20 years ago. Being absent-minded, Hirohito often strolls through the imperial palace with his pants undone. He is unbothered by the many visible moles on his face or the fact that he often has trouble seeing even though he constantly wears thick spectacles. At 5 feet 5 inches tall, Hirohito is the smallest of the world's wartime leaders, though he surpasses the 5 feet 6 inch Winston Churchill on those ceremonial occasions when he dons his thick-soled cavalry boots. He continues to live in splendor as the war forces the Japanese people to endure enormous deprivation. But there is little resentment among his subjects, who celebrate him as their cosmic life force. In turn, the citizens of Japan know themselves as the Shido Minzoku, the chosen people. The irony is that Hirohito ventures out of the castle so infrequently that he considers his life to be that of a bird in a cage. So great is his isolation that Hirohito has never actually addressed his subjects. Instead, his proclamations are printed and then distributed throughout Japan. Few of his subjects know the sound of his voice. Many of them have no idea what their emperor even looks like. Footnote: Japan is made up of 6,852 islands, of which just 430 are inhabited. The four largest and most populous are Honshu, Hokkaido, Shikoku, and Kyushu. The capital city of Tokyo is located on Honshu's eastern shores. End footnote. Still, the soldiers of the Imperial Japanese Army fight to the death in his name. Even though Hirohito publicly prefers to let his military leaders conduct the war, he plays a pivotal role. In 1937, when Japanese troops conquered the Chinese city of Nanking, slaughtering hundreds of thousands of civilians in the process, Hirohito pronounced himself deeply satisfied. And while he worried that the Pearl Harbor attack would pull Japan into a reckless war with the United States, he did nothing to stop his generals and admirals from proceeding. Now, as he eats lunch within his lavish Tokyo palace, Hirohito is paying particular attention to the battle for the Philippine island of Leyte, which he has ordered commanding Japanese general Tomoyuki Yamashita to hold at all costs. The emperor has allowed his prime minister, the former army intelligence officer Kuniaki Koiso, to publicly declare that Leyte will be Japan's greatest military victory since the long-ago Battle of Yamazaki in 1582, which began a period of Japanese reunification. Footnote: Prior to this battle, Japan was ruled by the daimyo, samurai lords, who established their own small kingdoms. Forces led by Toyotomi Hideyoshi defeated those of the shogun, military dictator, Akechi Mitsuhide, thus beginning the reunification of Japan. Hideyoshi's brilliant generalship has been compared to that of Napoleon Bonaparte. Daimyo rule remained in effect in some areas of Japan, coming to an end in 1871. End footnote. The emperor's public proclamations are bluster. He is aware that the Philippines may indeed fall, but he will do anything to prevent the Americans from conquering Japan. The United States would first have to take the key islands of Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and perhaps Formosa, so the Japanese have at least a year to prepare. For the past 3 months, a campaign has been underway to arm every citizen of Japan. Military training is now mandatory in all schools and places of employment. The nation's air defense network is being upgraded to prevent attack by American bombers. And Hirohito himself is involved in the development of sure victory weapons, a form of unconventional warfare against which the Americans will be powerless. Hirohito has approved the launching of these weapons. If all goes well, these hydrogen balloons carrying incendiary bombs and anti-personnel weapons will waft skyward from Japan 5 miles up into the jet stream, which will then whisk them 5,000 miles across the Pacific to America. There, the explosives will detonate in cities and towns, surprising an American public that thinks it is safe from attack. In this way, the people of the United States will see for themselves that Japan will never be defeated. These firebombs will fall from the sky as if hurled down by the hand of a vengeful god. From his vast castle in the middle of Tokyo, Emperor Hirohito's divine power will shock the barbaric Americans. Of this, the emperor is certain. Footnote: The so-called fire balloons were indeed launched. Most did not reach America, and those that did inflicted little damage. Yet the fire balloons were history's first intercontinental weapons. Not until 1982 and the Operation Black Buck raids of the Falklands War would they be surpassed as the longest-range attacks ever conducted. End footnote. The Second World War officially began on September 1, 1939, with Germany's invasion of Poland. But that act of aggression took place 2 years after Japan sought to increase its sphere of influence by conquering the northeastern provinces of China, collectively known as Manchuria, a region the Japanese had renamed Manchukuo. the world's great powers were at a loss as how to stop them. Like Formosa, which Japan colonized in 1895, and Korea, colonized in 1910, Manchuria both enriched Dai Nippon and gave it enough power to compete with China and the Soviet Union as a leading power in Asia. But Japanese military leaders did not stop there. In fact, they could not. As an island nation, Japan is lacking in many natural resources. Chief among these are oil and rubber, two items vital to military mobility. The bulk of Japan's oil, steel, and iron throughout the 1930s was imported from the United States, while the plantations of British Malaya provided Japan's rubber supply. These products continued to flow into Japan even after Japan invaded China in the summer of 1937. But by that time, the world's powers had grown wary of Japan's increasing belligerence. The United States, the Soviet Union, and even Germany began providing military aid to the Chinese, but it did not matter. Fighting in the name of Hakko Ichiyu, a belief that all of Asia must be united under one emperor, Japanese troops quickly overwhelmed China, their superior training and aggressive tactics devastating the forces of Chiang Kai-shek. The Japanese did not limit their killing to Chinese soldiers. At 10 o'clock on 29 November 1937, we left to clean out the enemy in Shangshu, and at noon we entered the town, Japanese Army Doctor Hosaka Akira wrote in his 3x5-inch pocket journal. An order was received to kill the residents, and 80 of them, men and women of all ages, were shot to death. I hope this will be the last time I'll ever witness such a scene. The people were all gathered in one place. They were all praying, crying, and begging for help. I just couldn't bear watching such a pitiful spectacle. Soon the heavy machine guns opened fire, and the sight of those people screaming and falling to the ground is one I could not face, even if I had had the heart of a monster. By December 1937, the Japanese had captured the capital city of Nanking. Prior to that, the battle for Shanghai during the autumn months of 1937 had cost the Japanese 92,000 casualties. More than 200,000 Chinese also lost their lives. The Imperial Japanese Army immediately sought revenge for their Shanghai dead, inflicting horrifying atrocities on the civilian population. The Japanese began their killing spree with the execution of 90,000 captured Chinese soldiers. In a pattern of behavior that displayed Japan's contempt for the Geneva Conventions, which protect prisoners of war from torture, assault, or execution, these men were stabbed to death, hung by their tongues, attacked by dogs, set ablaze, machine-gunned, buried alive, and beheaded. Footnote: the first Geneva Convention of 1864 was signed by Japan in 1886. Subsequent agreements were produced in 1906 and 1929. Japan signed the 1929 treaty and verbally agreed to adhere to the terms of the 1906 treaty. The emperor obviously did not live up to his word. End footnote. Next, civilians in the city were shot at random, sometimes being forced to dig their own graves beforehand. Japanese soldiers held horrifying killing contests in which they strived to see who could behead the most Chinese. Those barbarous acts were a mere prelude to what became of the women of Nanking, an estimated 80,000 of whom were systematically raped. Japanese soldiers would recount for years to come how much they enjoyed these acts, often perpetrated against children and grandmothers. Teams of Japanese soldiers developed a routine for each assault. The group would hold a victim down while one man checked to ensure that the woman did not have a sexually transmitted disease. Then the soldiers would cast lots to see who would go first. Victims were often bayoneted after the last man finished. If a woman was pregnant at the time, the baby might be cut from her womb with a knife. If the soldiers who fought in the name of Emperor Hirohito came upon a family, it was common for them to force fathers to rape their daughters, brothers to rape their sisters, and even sons to rape their mothers. Those females who survived these horrors often went on to become comfort women for the Japanese soldiers who would occupy China until 1945. These sexual slaves had no choice but to endure many more years of rape. In all, the Japanese systematically defiled and murdered half of Nanking's 600,000 citizens. Their behavior was hardly a secret. The people of Japan thrilled to news that the Chinese were being savagely tyrannized. In Tokyo, the Japan Advertiser ran a daily tally of the dead in a decapitation contest between two prominent Japanese soldiers. Back in Washington, D.C., President Roosevelt and Congress all but ignored the Japanese atrocities. When the New York Times printed a front-page story about the brutality in Nanking, the article was treated with skepticism. Some Americans considered the rape of Nanking too gruesome to be true, and the American leadership stayed silent. When the Japanese continued their military expansion with the invasion of French Indochina in 1940, President Roosevelt embargoed the sale of all oil to Japan. As an ally of America, Great Britain soon followed suit. On July 26, 1941, FDR went a step further and froze all Japanese assets in the United States. On the surface, FDR's action was a simple attempt to stop Japanese aggression in Asia. Yet it sent shockwaves through the Japanese military. Without oil, their tanks and ships would be useless. Japan's navy had a 6-month reserve of fuel, but no more. Japan's top generals began making plans to find new sources of oil. Japan began to see itself as a victim of American aggression. Unfortunately, rather than discouraging war in the Pacific, Roosevelt's embargo made it more likely. As tensions rose between Japan and the United States, the Japanese military came up with a most audacious plan. It would invade every nation, island, and colony that could offer it natural resources. In a matter of days, Japanese forces would spill onto the beaches of the Philippines, Singapore, the Dutch East Indies, British Malaya, Sarawak, and British and Dutch Borneo, and into the jungles of Burma. Prisoners taken along the way would be put to work as slave labor, building infrastructure, harvesting on plantations, and digging in the mines. The plan was horrifying but brilliant. While Japanese aggression was not unexpected, the scope of this outrageous design would catch the rest of the world flat-footed. Japanese generals hoped the element of surprise would guarantee total victory. The peace-loving prime minister at the time, Fumimaro Konoha, hoped for a diplomatic breakthrough with the United States, but by October 1941 it was quite clear this would not come to pass. Konoha then resigned, not having the stomach for a brutal world war. His replacement was Hideki Tojo, a short, arrogant army general. Nicknamed Razor for his brusque demeanor and attention to detail, 56-year-old Tojo distinguished himself on the field of battle in the early days of the war in China. He is descended from Japan's venerated samurai warrior class. Selected over others who thought him too militaristic, Tojo was hand-picked by Emperor Hirohito to serve as the new prime minister, making him the second most powerful man in Japan. His pro-war stance made it very clear how he would wield that strength. "We have finally committed to war," a high-level Japanese official will write in his journal shortly after Tojo's selection. "And now we must do all we can to launch it powerfully." For those who opposed his jingoistic attitude, Tojo had a simple argument. Sometimes it is necessary to shut one's eyes and take the plunge. Tojo had to manage two key elements if the plunge was to succeed. The first was Hirohito himself. For months, the emperor wavered on whether or not to expand Japan's war with China to include a continuation of its conquest of Asia and vital Pacific island nations within its sphere of influence. Of course, His Majesty is a pacifist, and there is no doubt he wished to avoid war, former Prime Minister Konoha will write on the day he resigns from office in October 1941, knowing that his attempts to prevent war will be in vain. "When I told him that to initiate war is a mistake, he agreed. Gradually, he began to lean toward war. Through Tojo's careful ministrations, Hirohito became more hawkish. At first, the emperor was reluctant to give his final blessing to the attack plans. But on November 2, 1941, just 2 weeks after Tojo took office, his persuasion won the day. Hirohito agreed that it was time to complete the Japanese mission of conquest, which left one last stumbling block to Japanese victory in what the nation will come to call the Greater East Asia War, the United States Navy. No other force was capable of stopping Japan's mighty fleet as it sailed forth through the Pacific, sending aloft its planes and delivering waves of soldiers to foreign beaches. As long as the U.S. Navy loomed as a threat, Tojo could never be completely assured of Japanese success. So in addition to overseeing the invasion plans that would place tiny Japan in a position of dominance no other Asian nation had ever known, Tojo also made Emperor Hirohito aware of plans to destroy America's Pacific Fleet. All of it. For years, the Japanese military had known its primary adversary might eventually be the United States. Although himself opposed to embroiling Japan in a dangerous and costly war, Commander-in-Chief of Japan's Combined Fleet, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, had long been in favor of an aerial bombardment that would destroy the dagger being pointed at our throats, as he referred to the U.S. fleet. The attack would happen on a Sunday morning, a time when most sailors would be sleeping in after a night on the town. Waves of carrier-launched Japanese dive bombers would drop from the skies, unloading torpedoes and bombs that would sink destroyers and demolish airplanes, forever ending America's naval presence in the Pacific. Yamamoto knew just where to find these ships. They were anchored bow to stern and side by side at a balmy tropical naval base in Hawaii, a place known as Pearl Harbor. On November 8, 1941, Emperor Hirohito was provided with specific details about the surprise attack. After very little deliberation, he approved the plan. Footnote: President Roosevelt had ordered the Pacific Fleet's headquarters moved from San Pedro, California, to Pearl Harbor in May 1940. This intended show of strength instead became a vulnerability. End footnote. Since the start of the war, Hirohito has allowed his generals and admirals to be the military face of the nation. He has been content to let the world view him as a man of peace forced into the conflict by his military advisors. But now, well into 1944, as the American Army and Navy edge ever closer to Japan, Hirohito takes a more intentional stance to defend the land his predecessors have ruled since 660 BC. Hirohito's first step was to oust the fanatical Tojo, the prime minister who often behaved like a dictator during the early days of the war. Indeed, Tojo has become as synonymous with Japan as Hitler is with Germany and Mussolini with Italy. But unlike those Axis allies, Tojo has been serving at the pleasure of the emperor. In July, the pivotal island of Saipan fell to the Americans, and Tojo's fate was sealed. Saipan's airfields are close enough to Tokyo that United States Army Air Force's B-29s can now bomb Japan at will. This fact has irreversibly changed how the war is waged, forcing Japan into a defensive stance. The days when a similar long-range bombing attack could be launched against the Americans are over. On July 18, 1944, 2 months before the Battle for Peleliu, Hirohito withdrew his support for Tojo's government. The prime minister was immediately removed from office. It was a crushing humiliation for the ruthless Tojo, who had orchestrated Japan's war strategy since before Pearl Harbor, and whom many had once thought invincible. So great was Tojo's loss of face that many called for him to commit ritual suicide. Instead, he retired to a farmhouse on the outskirts of Tokyo, longing for the day when the emperor might once again call him to public service. Hirohito has become the consummate wartime sovereign, sharing responsibility for Japan's tactical maneuvers and supporting Tojo's strategy of slaughtering innocent civilians and executing prisoners of war. Since the days leading up to Pearl Harbor, and even after forcing Tojo from office, Hirohito has immersed himself in the smallest details of wartime planning. The Emperor is fed daily reports from the Army and Navy apprising him of their actions. Many Japanese military leaders refuse to publicly acknowledge the string of defeats that has all but sealed the nation's fate. But in his rare moments of pragmatism, Hirohito knows that his fleet is almost completely destroyed, most of his airplanes have been shot down, and that the precious gas and steel that were the catalysts for this war can no longer be imported due to the ring of U.S. submarines and warships now forming a tight blockade around Japan. Yet despite this knowledge, and all other indications that the war is lost, the Emperor refuses to seek peace. His stated goal is to remain in this divine land and fight to the death.